Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Everyone looks to Singapore as a role model for what they want their country to be. Several countries from China to Rwanda hope to emulate its high administrative competence, standard of living, and quote-unquote social harmony. Post-Brexit Britain wants to copy the city-state's assertive and independent position in the world economy and its aggressive support for international business. Housing policy advocates look to Singapore's 90% home ownership rate in devising their own policies. And as I can tell you, as someone in Hong Kong, there are few things that people here of all persuasions like to do more than to compare themselves to Singapore. But these are all simplistic views of the city-state that miss its history, its opportunities, and its challenges. Jeevan Vassaher's Lion City, Singapore, and the Invention of Modern Asia, published by Little Brown earlier this year, delves into these more complicated details, giving a better portrayal of the city and the choices it's made as it tries to navigate a more complicated global environment. Jeevan is the environment editor for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and was formerly the Financial Times correspondent for Singapore and Malaysia. Today, Jeevan and I will talk about, well, Singapore, its history, its leadership, and its policies. We'll talk about how its administration is trying to chart a future for the country and whether that might be successful. So, Jeevan, thank you so much for joining me today. Let's start with perhaps a very straightforward question. What makes Singapore interesting as a place to examine in the way you do in your book?
Hi, Nicholas. Thanks for having me on. The beginning of my interest in Singapore was the beginning of my interest in writing a book about Singapore was with the Brexit moment in the UK, and actually sort of in the run-up to Brexit when Singapore was being described as a role model for the UK after leaving the European Union. And I thought it was interesting how Singapore was consistently seen as this free market paradise when I knew that it wasn't that. I knew the reality was quite different, and I understood the extent of state intervention in Singapore. What I also thought was interesting about this was that you had a sort of knee-jerk response from critics, particularly on the left, saying that Singapore was authoritarian, and from many people saying, well, Singapore is very, very boring. There's nothing of interest about it. And I thought all of these views of Singapore were inaccurate. They were all wrong. None of them really understood the sort of complex and messy reality of the place. And I thought there was something to be written about what Singapore actually is, the extent to which it could be a role model for other countries, and why it wasn't particularly a role model for Britain.
So perhaps let's start with, when going through Singapore's history, with talking about the man who founded it, Raffles. What was Raffles' goal in establishing Singapore, and how has his influence and his idea for the place continue to affect Singapore today?
So there's obviously a long history of Singapore as a trading settlement, as a point where fishermen and merchants from across the region congregated before the British arrived and before there was European settlement and colonization in Asia. But I take as a sort of key starting point, really, for Singapore's modern history, the founding of the modern settlement by Raffles. And he was an unusual figure in terms of his outlook. So absolutely kind of committed to free trade, had this liberal view of empire as sort of civilizational force, obviously one that we can make sort of pretty trenchant criticisms of, but one that was significant and had a great significance for the way that Lee Kuan Yew saw Singapore's colonial history. And Raffles saw Singapore as a key sort of staging point for British influence, a way to extend British influence east of India and create this staging post between India and China. And at the time, the key European rivalry was between the British and the Dutch. And he saw it as a way to get one up on the Dutch, essentially, and establish British influence in a region where it had very, very limited sway.
So Singapore, you know, is a British colony, it's developed by the British, and then comes independence, and you have this very, you can call it an awkward transition period, where Singapore tries to join with Malaysia in a larger federation. That doesn't work out. They have a divorce a few years later. How was the relationship with first Malaya and then later Malaysia affect how Singapore sees itself?
I'd say there's a complex relationship between Malaya and Singapore. And the two countries are really like cousins, but it's a very strong kind of familial relationship. So you have the same ethnic communities in both countries, Chinese, Malay, Tamil, slightly different majorities, obviously, in both. So clearly a Malay majority in present-day Malaysia, a Chinese majority in present-day Singapore. But if you go back in time, you know, these weren't sort of really separate identities. It was one Malaya, a syncretistic culture, one in which people were sharing food, speaking each other's languages, had some history of intermarriage. When you look at the sort of political construction of modern Malaysia, modern Singapore, there's obviously a really contrasting idea of what the nations exist for. And Lee Kuan Yew's idea of Malaysia, as I understand it, was one that had a greater degree of ethnic plurality, and one that was founded on a somewhat different idea from the much more sort of racially identified conception that has taken hold in Malaysia. This is obviously a very controversial point, but my argument is that present-day Malaysia is really constructed pretty strongly along the lines of ethnic Malay privilege, you might argue, and one in which ethnic Malays are guaranteed certain rights above other communities. Lee Kuan Yew's vision of Singapore is somewhat different from that. Now, we can talk about how Singapore has worked out in practice, but that vision of Singapore, of one that's based on ethnic plurality, of greater meritocracy, is quite different from that sort of very racial view of Malaysia. So there's a really fundamentally different way of seeing the two societies.
You know, you mentioned Lee Kuan Yew, and it really is impossible to talk about Singapore without talking about Lee Kuan Yew. How did his views, his ideology, and his personality affect Singapore's development after independence?
So he's obviously an enormous kind of historical figure for Singapore and for Asia. And I think one of the things that is really striking about him, if you look at his personality and his background, is in a way how out of his society he is. So he's someone who had a very kind of English, very colonial upbringing, went to an elite school, the Raffles Institution, then went on to study at Cambridge, studied read law at Cambridge, learned to speak Chinese later in life. And there's a sort of revealing details in his own biographical writing. So when he talks about going out campaigning in some of the poorer parts of town in Singapore, he sort of describes sort of feeling sort of disgusted by open sewers, seeing rats running around, having to come back home and have a bath afterwards to sort of clean himself properly. Not someone who was, you know, fully sort of, you know, in a way, not someone who's sort of fully within the sort of Chinese society of Singapore, not someone who kind of fully understood its stories, its traditions, someone who was, you know, very, very strongly sort of shaped by the colonial influence. And I think you can see the imprint of that in a great deal in modern Singapore. So it's a society that's sort of between two worlds, between East and West. And that's a legacy of this man who kind of effectively created it and has that split between Asia and Europe.
So I'd like to transition now from the history of Singapore to kind of how this city-state is constructed today. Singapore is often presented as a free market society, both by its own government and also by outside admirers. Yet the government builds public housing. I think it helps control drug prices. It conducts other social interventions. How does one kind of understand this apparent contradiction between this idea of Singapore as a small, open, free market economy, yet also one that does a lot of these social interventions?
So the state in Singapore plays an absolutely central role in the economy. It's very much the government that says we're setting out to encourage particular sectors. We're setting out to say what kind of economy we want to have. You know, we'd like to hold manufacturing at a certain level. We'd like to encourage the growth of Singapore as a financial center. So it has a clear vision for how it wants the economy to develop. At the same time, there is a pretty robust welfare state, as you've pointed out. So certainly in areas like housing, you know, the majority of the population living in public housing, free universal education. I guess the connection between these two parts, these two apparent contradictions, is to say that there's a very, very clear sense in Singapore of how society should look. And that's driven from the top down. And certainly Lee Kuan Yew and Singapore's elite did believe in markets and saw the market economy and saw capitalism as something they were part of. And this was the way for society to prosper. But they also saw a very, very clear role for government in providing a strong but narrow welfare state that was designed to create educated and productive workers that would fit into this economy. So that the two sort of really go together. It's a very different model, I would say, from the sort of liberal Anglo-Saxon model that Britain and the US follow, or Britain and the US sort of talk about. But it's a very familiar model in other parts of the world. So it's much more Germanic, much more similar to the Japanese social model.
But Singapore, I think, has also been very successful in attracting international companies to be based in Singapore, whether in manufacturing and services, I think more recently in tech. I know Singapore is very proud of its record in attracting startups and venture capital and all that stuff. But I guess, why has Singapore been so successful? Is it just the characteristics that it has as an open economy, or has there been actual government effort and government policy in attracting these companies?
So there's certainly very active government wooing of these companies in desirable sectors. And that takes a number of forms. So there are tax breaks for companies that come and set up in Singapore. And the government goes out to, you know, to regularly sort of, you know, pursue these companies and invite them to come and set up in the country. Singapore is also a very, very appealing place to set up if you're a foreign business seeking an entry point into Asia. The bureaucracy is very efficient, very minimal. It's very straightforward to set yourself up there. There's a highly educated white-collar workforce. And there's also, if you're a manufacturer, a significant kind of low-paid migrant workforce. So the costs aren't necessarily that high of doing business in Singapore. And it's also kind of obviously strategically located. So it's in Southeast Asia with a booming middle class. It's the perfect place to set up if you're looking to tap into that.
Maybe let's kind of move on now to kind of some of the other, beyond economics, some of the more kind of social aspects of Singapore. You know, the government has made trying to achieve, you know, quote unquote, racial harmony and active policy. It does this through things like its housing policy, where it tries to build diverse public housing estates. But in practice, and in your view, how successful has Singapore been in kind of developing a multicultural, multi-ethnic society that does not see these tensions?
That's a really interesting question. I would say that there is a clear sense of Singaporean identity. And that's partly something that's formed naturally and partly something that's sort of shaped by the government. So as you've mentioned, Nicholas, there is this policy of ensuring there's an ethnic mix in every neighborhood and in every housing block. And that means that schools are mixed. There's a high level of interaction amongst neighbors and that people get to know each other, share each other's food, understand bits of each other's languages. There's a sense that, you know, being Singaporean is this mixed kind of blended identity that's different from its neighbors. And, you know, if you're a Chinese Singaporean, you're not Chinese. If you're an Indian Singaporean, you're not Indian. You have your own identity. At the same time, there are distinct issues around race. I think that Singapore hasn't really settled yet. There is a sense that the Chinese ethnicity is the dominant ethnicity in Singapore. A sense that a non-Chinese person would be very difficult for a non-Chinese person to advance to the very top of Singaporean society to become the prime minister, I think would be, is still sort of clearly something that is seen as problematic. And I think there is a clear sense that if you're a Singaporean Malay, you're disadvantaged in various ways. You'll earn less than other ethnic communities, and it'll be more difficult for you to advance, particularly in the military, where there's historically been distrust of Singaporean Malays and sort of concern about putting Singaporean Malays into sensitive positions, because Malaysia and Indonesia have been the sort of traditional historical sort of rivals in the region of Singapore.
So to take a bigger picture view again, there's a proposed relationship between economic development and political openness. Either development leads to greater openness, or openness helps lead to growth, or whatever, however that relationship happens. But Singapore seems to be kind of awkwardly placed in this conversation. Singapore has, in the past, has been quite constraining of opposition politicians. It's arrested them in the past, in the 60s and the 80s. Obviously, its media scene is more, also somewhat more constrained than other places. Yet, of course, it's still a thriving business center. It's still a thriving open economy. It's a thriving society. So I guess in talking about this, again, entirely theoretical trade-off between, or trade-off, theoretical relationship between openness and development, where does Singapore fit into this conversation?
I'd say you can see a number of societies around Asia which have made similar trade-offs between openness, political openness, and economic progress. So if you look at Taiwan and Korea, they've both gone through relatively authoritarian phases when their economies were developing and have transitioned into more democratic societies as their middle classes have grown, as more people have gone to universities, as more people have joined trade unions and really demanded their rights. Singapore hasn't quite gone through the same trajectory. And I think that there are sort of two interesting aspects of this. One is that there's been a very clear return to the Singaporean population in terms of economic prosperity from early on. And that's they've really seen their lifestyles improve dramatically, and they've accepted limits to political freedom as a sort of compact. The other point that I'd like to make is that while Singapore has been repressive in the past, it's never really been used sort of deadly force on its citizens to the same extent that you've seen in other countries. In my book, I spoke to a dissident who was arrested and mistreated in Singapore, but said one reassuring thing was that he knew that he wouldn't be killed. He knew that that didn't happen in Singapore, that sort of extrajudicial, arbitrary use of extreme state violence that you do see in other countries. I do think that Singapore is likely to go through a similar kind of transition to the one that we've seen in other countries. I think it may well be slower and more gradual, but I think it will come nonetheless.
So Singapore, I think, has been very successful at implementing its public objectives, in attracting manufacturing, in attracting international business, in attracting tech, in kind of building up its own defense in a complicated environment. And it basically succeeds in most of its objectives, with one, I would say, pretty significant exception, which is becoming an international financial center. They're constantly trying to make their stock market, be of international quality. It never quite gets there. I think today they just announced a fund to really kind of bolster the stock market even more. And the reason why I bring this up is Singapore doesn't necessarily have some of the geographical infrastructural advantages that other financial centers do, being very close to major economies like New York, London, and Hong Kong are. Doesn't have the same maybe depth of infrastructure. And so the reason I ask this or bring this up is to ask, is Singapore's success due to this ability from its administration to really chart its own path in the global environment? Or is it perhaps more just intelligently capitalizing on advantages it already has and using them to its fullest extent? But where they don't exist, it struggles like everyone else does.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Nicholas. I would say that you're right that Singapore's made sort of brilliant use of some of its natural advantages and really built on those. And a good case in point, I would say, is the petrochemical industry. I mean, obviously, Singapore has no oil reserves of its own, but it's become a regional center for oil storage, for petrochemicals, and that's on the basis of its sort of maritime location. So it's perfectly located for shipping. When it comes to finance and its role as a financial center, I'd say there are some areas where it has been very successful. So it's developed very successfully a wealth management center. So lots of wealth managers in Singapore.
And venture capital, and that, of course, too, yeah.
And VC and other sectors like insurance. The stock market is an interesting case because I think that relates to the fact that Southeast Asia is so fragmented as a region. So it obviously, it's not like Singapore is not like directly equivalent to Hong Kong in the sense where Hong Kong can be the gateway between China and the West for sort of flows of capital in both directions. Singapore is part of a much more fragmented region, much more politically fragmented region. Other countries in the region may turn a blind eye to some of their citizens' wealth being stored in Singapore. They're much more reluctant to see their companies listing on the Singapore Stock Exchange. Clearly, if the government is a sort of, big holder of investments, or national governments are big holders of investments in those companies, they're much more reluctant to see those going to Singapore rather than being listed in Kuala Lumpur or in Bangkok. So I think, it may never overcome some of those disadvantages, the disadvantage of being part of this this small and disparate region. But it does a terrific job at making use of the advantages that it has.
So I'd like to end with a personal question, if I might, and that's to ask about your own feelings about Singapore. I think you obviously were based there for work. I believe you have a personal family connection to the place. Your father is from there, if I'm correct.
That's right.
Yes. So I guess, what are your own feelings about Singapore as someone with a personal connection to the city?
Yes, so just to explain a bit of my personal background, my father was born in Sri Lanka, but he migrated to Singapore when he was a boy and grew up there. And I have a half-sister who's Singaporean, so some Singaporean family. I've always had a sort of strong connection to the place. We traveled back and forth regularly as children, so I knew Singapore food very well. I admired it. One of my earliest childhood memories is flying from Heathrow, arriving at Changi Airport, and seeing that there was Tamil script in the LCD display at Changi. And the reason I mention that is because for me, it was striking to see that Singapore could be an Asian edition of the modern world, that it was, an advanced, developed society, but nonetheless one that was in touch with its traditional cultures. And that was really, really striking to me. I have a somewhat awkward relationship with it because as much as I admire Singapore, as much as I think it's an efficient and comfortable society, I am irked by the fact that its citizens so frequently censor themselves in conversation, the fact that there's so little political freedom. And I'm used to the kind of open discussion that you can have in so many other societies, particularly in the West and in other Asian societies, and find it odd in Singapore that people are so reluctant to criticize the government, people are so reluctant to sort of speak freely about political topics. I understand, for historical reasons, because there has been this strong political control, why people should feel reluctant to do that. But at the same time, I don't find it a particularly comfortable place to live for that reason. There is a sort of feeling sometimes of being a sort of bird in a gilded cage. Your surroundings are very, very pleasant, but don't cross the boundaries that everyone's aware of. I both admire it, but I'm unsure whether I'd ever choose to live there, if they'd have me after I've said all this in public.
So with that, I think that ends our interview with Jeevan Vazaher, author of Lion City, Singapore and the Invention of Modern Asia. Jeevan, I actually do have one more question for you, which is, where can people find your work and what's next for you?
So my book is available online on Amazon and other internet booksellers, and also in Kinokuniya in Singapore and in Kuala Lumpur. and obviously bookstores in the UK. So what's next? I'm currently working as environment editor at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, as you mentioned. Our focus is on emissions from industrial farming, and I'll be looking to expand our reporting through COP26 and across the next year and the coming years, which is so critical for our engagement with climate change.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Timon Screech, author of The Shogun's Silver Telescope, God, Art, and Money in the English Quest for Japan, 600-625. But before then, thank you so much, Jeevan, for joining me today.
Thank you, Nicholas.